Welcome to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. This is Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack. And in today's episode, I'm sitting down with Pioneer Place Theater Company's creative director Jay Terry, who's also the director and designer for a play opening up this weekend on Friday, March 10th at the Pioneer Place that brings to life some of the historic bedrock of what makes St. Cloud, St. Cloud. It's The Wizard of Progress, the Sam Pandolfo story, and it runs all the way through Sunday, March 26th. So welcome, Jay, to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota.
Yeah, the show is called The Wizard of Progress, the Sam Pandolfo story.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting story because this is one of these strange defining moments of St. Cloud, the St. Cloud area.
Yeah, there was a time actually that St. Cloud, I mean, if things had gone better for him, it is entirely likely that St. Cloud could have become something more along the lines of a Detroit, or which I don't know if that's necessarily a badge of honor these days for Detroit, but St. Cloud was definitely on its way to growing, and there was even talk of that St. Cloud could have become the capital, just because of its location on the Mississippi River. We had access to the Duluth Seaport or the Lake Port. You know, that's a big deal. So St. Cloud was a prime location to have industry, which is so funny because now St. Cloud almost has none. We have Electrolux, which actually, believe it or not, is in the old Pandolfo factory.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. Where exactly was the factory?
It was where Electrolux is. And then there's like that red brick building over there, over on 33rd and 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
That was the original offices for the Pan Motor Company.
Hmm. Yeah, these little landmarks. And then Pantown, of course, with all the...
Yeah, everyone knows Pantown. So every time I've been, like, people have asked me about the show, I say, like, well, it's about Sam Pandolfo. And they're like, oh, I've never heard of that. I'm like, well, you've heard of Pantown, I bet, the bus line. And they're like, oh, yeah, Pantown. And they're like, well, what is that? I'm like, well, it was... I mean, the guy literally built a small town, a section of St. Cloud...
For the workers.
For the workers, yeah. and his administrators to live in. So they had housing, and every house had it was like a house and then an empty lot, and then a house and an empty lot. And actually, believe it or not, my mom grew up in one of the Pantown houses, and they still have the empty lot. It's one of the only houses in Pantown that still retains that empty lot next to it as part of the property.
Oh, yeah, and there's a particular style to the homes, too. And once you pay attention to it, you're like, oh, yeah, and they look pretty neat.
Yeah, it's cool. You can see every other house is that style. Yeah.
So why don't we have a brief rundown just of the history of Pandolfo and what exactly did he do?
Yeah, so Sam Pandolfo was originally from Alabama and sold insurance. But prior to that, actually, he was a school teacher, but decided he would like to make a living for a living. So he got out of education and decided to start selling insurance and traveled. He sold a lot of insurance out of his car. So he was in cars a lot. He owned a number of cars, early cars. I mean, this is when cars were just like a brand new thing.
Yeah, this is right around Model T era.
Not long after.
Yeah.
And he drove some good cars, some bad cars. So he knew what the traveling businessman needed in an automobile, and the traveling family man needed, He was really focused on making the driving and traveling experience better. The engineering of a good engine and a good suspension and good wheels and all that kind of stuff, that's more for the, the automobile designers to deal with. But what his primary concern was, like, what is the end user experience? So...
He had all sorts of modifications you don't really think of with those early cars.
Yeah, he had, the front headlights, on those old cars, the hood kind of opened from the side.
Yep.
It had that sort of long nose on the car, and the hood opened from the side. And then the headlights could spin around, pivot around, and shine into the engine compartment.
Yeah, so you can actually see
what you're doing. So you can see what you're doing, yeah. So you could, like, if your car broke down and you needed to work on it, there was a you could have some power to the lights, and you could see what's going on in there. Very useful. He had compartments for refrigeration in the Model A, so you could keep food and provisions cold, which still isn't in very many cars. That's like a really high end car, like a luxury car now. And it was considered a luxury model, the Model A, but to have compartments like coolers, kind of like what a boat has.
Yeah,
boats have those like sort of refrigerated cooler compartments. So that was in there in the Model A. It also, the back seat folded down into a full size sleeping bed.
Yep.
Or it'd be like a twin size bed, but basically you could sleep laying down in the car. And that was another thing. It was like, I want you to be able to go on the road and the car is the only thing you need. You've got your food. You've got your housing. It can keep you dry and you can keep it running. It was like he had a lot of compartments on there for spare parts and this kind of thing. And, cars broke down a lot more than they do now. And there were no phones, there were no tow trucks. So you needed to be prepared to
fix it on the road.
Fix it yourself on the road. And he kept that in mind in designing the car.
Nice. And what's kind of neat is you can actually see one of these cars.
Stearns County History Museum has one.
The Stearns History Museum. I was going to ask you a little later how it feels,
There are five in existence.
Oh, yeah.
One of them is owned by the Pantowners Club. It's like a car club. And then there's one, I think, in California, maybe by a private collector. And then there are three others in town. I know the Burnix family owns one. And I think there's another couple other private owners. Well, I believe the one in the Stearns County History Museum actually is privately owned and just kind of permanently lives there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is definitely an interesting vehicle.
So he chose St. Cloud just because of its location. The river has a big part to do with that. Being able to get materials from Duluth, and the Iron Range, Minnesota at the time was probably the greatest resource for iron and iron ore. And so his idea was not to, like many of the other car manufacturers, they were like having their parts made elsewhere and then shipped in and put together. His plan was to make the parts and put it together and finish it and roll it out the door. Like the whole idea was to keep everything that happens with this in St. Cloud. And I mean, it's just like you look at like a company like Amazon now. So they're the same thing. They're doing all the distribution, they're taking all the website, takes all the orders. Like it's all one within one place, and that's what keeps the cost down, for the consumer. So he was really focused on that. Also, St. Cloud was not unionized, and did not have that kind of mentality on. It's a German Catholic town. They were not interested in unionizing, and so the labor force there was attractive to him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go. So that's what made St. Cloud attractive. Now that is definitely not where the story ends.
No,
because this is just where it's beginning, and it's he ran into some very interesting situations here in town.
Yeah, so one of the ways he was so successful is he got people to invest in the company. He not only was he making cars, but he was also kind of almost treating the company like a capital company, like GE might be now today. So he was having, when you bought shares in Pan, those shares would go up in value and you could resell them or you could hold them. He really was pushing a lot of that, and they did that through a lot of promotional materials. And I think he picked up some of those things through the insurance business, how to use the mail to contact a broader audience. I mean, he was sending out millions of mailers, and was very successful in raising funds of getting people to invest, because not only are you creating a revenue stream coming into the company, but also you are creating customers. That's what he sort of was focused on, was like, yeah, if you can get people to like drink the Kool-Aid, so to speak, invest in the company, well, what kind of car are they going to buy then? They're going to buy a pan car, and they're going to try to, if they have their own money invested in the company, they're going to be the greatest tool for advertising, which is to tell their friends and everyone they know.
To show their friends.
Get a pan car, because I want my company, I have pride in it, I want, you know, the company to do well, so buy this car. You know, it
seems like a good idea.
It's a great idea, and it happens all the time today, but people weren't investing as much back then. You know, it was kind of a...
Well, what year was this?
These are like late teens, early 20s.
Okay.
Yeah, so... So he was very successful in getting investors to get on board, raised quite a bit of money. And but the Detroit guys, Ford and the steelworkers out east, did not like his success, and he was being targeted, you could say, because they wanted to squash his success, his progress, and one of the ways they did that is they got him indicted for mail fraud. And so the way that worked was he put out a mailer that had on it images of the Pan Motor Company as it was designed to be built.
Mm-hmm.
So he showed buildings on there that didn't exist yet. But he never lied in saying that they were designed to be built. You know, it says clearly on there that that's what was going to happen.
The future company or something.
Yeah. But... they made an argument that was somewhat misleading, that like, oh, invest in this company. And they're thinking, oh, that's what it is? Oh, great. Yeah, I want to invest in that. Well, it didn't exist quite yet. And then one of the other – the main thing that they nailed him for, what he actually was convicted for, was mail fraud, was because of a clause under one of the illustrations that said that it was an aeroplane view of the Pan Motor Company as designed and built by our engineers to be built, or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And the phrase airplane view is what ended up actually ruining him, because it was not taken from an airplane. The photo, it wasn't a photograph. It was like an artist's rendition of
what it would look like,
yeah. You know. And so, and the artist was never in an airplane to do that. And so, the prosecution made the argument that you can't say that was an airplane view when it wasn't an airplane view, and you're misleading people. Also, which I mean, that seems like such a technicality.
Yeah, it seems like a very little thing.
Yeah, and in the transcript, in fact, Pandolfo even says it is common knowledge that an airplane view is any view taken from an elevated position.
Yeah, that's grammar.
An airplane view needs to be taken from an airplane as much as a bird's eye view needs to be taken from a bird's eye, or better yet, which eye of the bird? You know, it's semantics. But when you are using the U.S. mail, it's pretty serious what you can and can't put in that. So he was convicted of mail fraud for that. Also, another thing that people took objection with was he had a tank tread tractor. Basically a tractor like you'd imagine, but instead of wheels, it had tank treads. And it was pretty cool, kind of like a Caterpillar today.
Yep.
And it was very successful. But because he called it the tank tread tractor, and in the marketing said that it was going to win the war, the tank tractor was going to win the war, they claimed that he was claiming that the tank tread tractor was going to be used in military service, which it wasn't. But he made the argument that there were lots of people at the time that were saying, you know, cigarettes will win the war. Buy cigarettes, or, you know, conservation of food will win the war. Buying Liberty bonds will win the war. The government was putting out those kinds of things. And so he was saying that, you know, by conserving manpower and horsepower, we can better serve our soldiers of the soil back home, and that will grow you know, and that'll help America win the war. You know, the fact that it was also called the tank tread tractor, I think, was sort of just a clever gimmick. You know, it could have been called a, I don't know, what, you know, some sort of rotary tread tractor or continuous tread and whatever.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But the fact that it was called a tank tread tractor and that he used that wartime slogan, they indicted him for that as well. So he ended up serving time in Leavenworth Prison, I believe 10 years. And when he got out of prison, he did start up a career again. He never went back to the Pan Motor Company. They tried to keep it running in his absence, but it didn't last and ended up failing. But he did, after prison, come back and had a career. He had like a line of health food items. Like he was trying to make healthier foods. Like I know one specific example was he had a greaseless donut that was like a baked donut that he was making and had like this pans that, you know. And so, but it was all about like kind of marketing. He was a genius of marketing and getting people to buy into his ideas. Had great ideas, but it's not like he was building cars.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had people that built cars. He was just the idea man, the pitch man, the dreamer.
You're in tune to 88.1 FM KVSC and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. Today we're talking with Jay Terry from the Pioneer Place Theater Company about the play The Wizard of Progress, the Sam Pandolfo story, opening Friday, March 10th, and running through March 26th. Now, as we get back into the conversation, we're going to talk about one of the more epic moments of the history of Sam Pandolfo, the infamous barbecue.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, tell us about the barbecue. This is epic.
So, yeah, he threw an enormous barbecue and invited all the investors. It was basically to show off the car, get investors involved, and they had like 15,000 pounds of beef at this barbecue, and like at the time, I think they tripled the size of St. Cloud for a day.
Yeah, you know, it brought in thousands of people.
It became like the second largest city in the state for a day.
Yeah,
thousands of people came to it, and the beef was like way undercooked because they were like trying to smoke it with like oak. And he brought in barbecue masters from like the South who are used to using like mesquite wood and stuff like that.
Different wood.
Yeah. And so it was this kind of, and the cars themselves were like falling apart. Like, so it was supposed to be a great, I mean, I guess in some ways it was a huge success because of all the people it drew in, but that there were plenty of things that went wrong with the barbecue.
Oh, yeah. They ended up getting a dust storm that blew
through. Yeah. And a dust storm came through and it was like a big, you know, actually, I'm sort of surprised that they don't mention the dust storm in the show. I kind of wish they did, because that's another nail in the coffin, you know, just like...
Yeah, it's like, how could this get worse? Oh, look, here's a dust storm. A
little grit in your potato salad there.
Yep. Well, why don't we chat for a second about what exactly is your role in the show or with the show? And
I'm the director and designer.
Okay. So...
Yeah, so basically, I mean, directing the show, I sort of... read the play and tell the actors, you know, how I want them to do it, character development, that kinds of thing.
Well, how is it like bringing something? Have you ever worked with something that is historic before? Because I mean, it's like somebody can go see the play, then they can just trot on over to the Stearns History Museum and basically fact check the play.
You could. And I would encourage you to do that. You know, the show is, there's a lot of historical information. They mention things like Fandles, which I believe now is Herberger's.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
They mentioned St. Cloud Normal School, which became St. Cloud State. They reference a couple different sort of local prominent people of the time. So all of that kind of stuff is factual. But in order to make it a drama, we do try to push the envelope as far as like what's interesting to watch, you know. So some of the scenes are just there to be somewhat dramatic. I don't know if Anna and Schwab ever had a meeting where they, you know, where she regretted all of the things that have happened, but it makes for a good play. You know, yeah. We need to see her have regrets and Schwab re-encourage her and him have all this confidence that no, we're not gonna be indicted. And then in the next scene, we see the courtroom scene, and you know, Judge Landis is very well known for being a very cranky, grumpy guy. You know, and we're playing that up as much as we can. There are things. It's definitely a lot of information in it. So I'm hoping that people are able to get all of that. But at the same time, we can do some storytelling, some character development, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The thing that anytime you do a historical show, the pitfall you can fall into, like if you do a show like, let's say, about like George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or something.
Or Hamilton.
There's always this sense, especially if it's like a local thing, there's always this sense of, oh, well, he's our local guy and he was a businessman. He must be a hero, right? Well, he was indicted for mail fraud and convicted. Now, you can look at that one of two ways. Mm-hmm. Was he targeted unjustly?
Or the business practice of
you were know, his big business three, practices not his, so great? Yep. You know, he had some interesting business practices that I think would be considered questionable today. For example, he bought. So when you were invested, there was a $5 basically fee. $5 was the price of the stock. And then there was a $5 what he called subscription fee, which went into a surplus account, which he had control of. That went for like buying housing for the workers, making like improvements to the town, to, like the sewers and that kind of stuff to sort of and then the rest of it he reinvested in the company, so to speak, to buy shares in his. So he used other people's money to buy shares in his own company. Mm. Which is sort of weird.
That you begin to get into that Ponzi scheme-ish almost.
Yeah, type thing. and so there are some things where it's kind of like, well, maybe you didn't break any laws, and
or maybe he just figured out a way of doing this before the laws were written that would make it illegal to do what he's doing.
Yeah, kind of like he's working. Well, it's kind of like, there's a very famous person right now who people are criticizing for maybe not paying very many taxes. And he goes, well, if I didn't pay any taxes, that makes me smart. It's like if you don't like the laws, change the laws. And it's like, well, you're in charge of the laws now, so. But it's one of these things where I don't want the viewer to come away from this thing necessarily going, well, Pan clearly was a victim of the system.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he was entirely faultless. At the same time, I don't want him to be a villain. But I want the viewer to come away from it going, huh, what this really is a story of, do you know Artemis?
Yeah.
You know, made the wax wings. I think it's Artemis, isn't it?
Icarus.
Icarus, that's Icarus. What it is, Icarus. The Greek legend who made the wax wings,
yeah.
And they were flying, and they flew too close to the sun, and they melted, and they fell. That, more or less, is the story of Pan. He rose quickly, he had a vision, he had a dream, and he launched himself, I would argue, too fast. He's called the Wizard of Progress. That's what the show is called. But he progressed too fast. I think if he had slow played it a little bit and just taken his time and was a little more careful and a little less ambitious, he might have had greater sustainability. Mm. That his biggest fault is that, you know, there's a scene in the show where they're trying to get the machine shop up and running. And they find out that this drop forge is going to cost $500 million or something like that, yeah. or $500,000 or something, some huge price tag. And he can't afford it, but he wants it anyway because that's what's going to make them independent of the other steel shops.
Yeah.
And
the vital equipment.
Yeah, this will and so
put them to that next level.
But then the investing didn't support that, and so it starts to sort of like And I think that's where he started to get a little desperate of like, well, where am I going to get this money? Let's take it from over there and move it over here. And now he's, you know, he's like always driving forward and he's not playing that flat game, you know, or at least with that little slight increase. He was trying to just rise to the top, become great, become enormous, make the greatest car anyone has ever known. And it will be the only car that is ever sold in America. And you can't do that and expect success. It's too much at one time.
So in a way, it's kind of the classic theater, though, because you've got a character. The character's got a flaw, and
yes.
It's because of that flaw,
yes.
Everything falls apart.
Hubris yeah. is probably his flaw.
Yeah, there you go.
And we're also kind of telling the story of a man who loses track of what's important, for example, with his family. You know, as we see things between he and his wife, that's probably the most interesting storyline in the show for me, is to see the interactions between him and his wife. She starts out supporting him, and you know, eventually I think she gets to a breaking point where she's probably had enough. And I'll just say, when he's in prison, it isn't his wife who's visiting him. And I think that is telling.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a family worker, like a maid or something like that, who's been loyal to the family, is the one visiting him in prison. She's sort of telling him about what's going on with the wife and the kids, but he doesn't know. So it's there is some tragedy there, too, that he loses track of his family, his wife, his children, because he's so focused on progress.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of cast you got? Pretty much all
locals. All locals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think I counted the other day. So there's five men, two women, and I think all but two are St. Cloud State grads. Including myself and including my stage manager, my assistant stage manager, who also has a small role in the show. Are all St. Cloud State alumni. It's a young cast. They're not I wouldn't necessarily say they're all age appropriate, but because they're all younger, it kind of works. Like we kind of believe that we're in that world. You know, Pandolfo would have been in his 40s. I think my Pan is about 30. But we're aging them a little bit through and characterization, a little bit of makeup maybe. Yeah,
the magic of makeup.
Yeah, but. But
not that much, yeah.
You know, Grant Hakey is in it. I think people would know him from town. Tyler Haugen is my Pandolfo. Hunter Goldsmith, graduated of St. Cloud State. Sam Nordstrom is my ASM, and also has a role. Jared Walls is in it. I don't think he went to St. Cloud State, but he lives in town. Megan Potter is in it. Abigail Elke is in it. She's a graduate of St. Cloud State. Also, Eli Mastin is a graduate of St. Cloud State, myself. So it's cool to have so many local actors in a show that about St. Cloud that are from the local university, and it's cool. I'm proud that we were able to do that. You know, I think, yes, we could have brought in Minneapolis actors for something like this, but I don't think it would have meant as much to the town to have local people doing it.
Mm, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, right on. Wizard of Progress at the Pioneer Place.
Yep.
Opening up this weekend, the 10th.
Yes.
And running through.
We've got 3 weeks. So, yep. We run Thursday. We open up on a Friday the 10th. But then the following weeks, it's Thursday through Sunday. And every night at 7:30 p.m., except for Sundays, is a 2 p.m. matinee. And they can get tickets at pp5.com.
There we go. Well, thanks for chatting today, Jay.
Thank you.
And we've been talking with Jay Terry, creative director for the Pioneer Place Theater Company, here on today's Untold Story of Central Minnesota. And once again, The Wizard of Progress, the Sam Pandolfo story, opens this Friday, March 10th, and runs through Sunday, March 26th, at the Pioneer Place Theater in downtown St. Cloud. Ticket information is available on their website at pp5.com. You can also link to that off of our website at kvsc.org under the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota tab and the link to this podcast. This has been Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota is made possible through support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Has been produced at KVSC, a proud member of Amper's Diverse Radio for Minnesota's communities.